from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George W. Bush and his Democratic rivals all love the middle class in this election year, and they want the middle class to know it. Everybody promises more jobs, better health care, and economic recovery. The promise of a middle-class life has long been central to the American ideal, says our guest tonight, journalist and author Michael Lind. And the promise was made good, he says, in no small part by government design. First, Washington boosted the farmer, then the industrial worker, then the white-collar worker. Now, in a new century, the middle class appears to be in trouble, and no one is sure of the next grand plan, the next big vision, for keeping it afloat. Tonight on Point, the history and future of America's embattled middle class. Can you see, do you feel the pressure on the middle class life today, the fear of falling? What's the next big frontier for middle class opportunity in the USA? Do we need a policy to make it happen, or just economic growth? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Lind, senior fellow at the New America Foundation, a centrist research group. He is author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics, and the forthcoming book, What Lincoln Believed, The Values and Convictions of America's Greatest President. His article, Are We Still a Middle-Class Nation, is in the most recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and welcome back to On Point, Michael Lind.
We're glad to be back.
It's wonderful to have you. An eye-opening article that you've got in the Atlantic. I guess I, like many Americans, you know, without thinking a lot about it, sort of assume that the middle class grew up out of the rich loam of America as a kind of natural fact, a kind of outcome of destiny. You say it wasn't so, Michael Lind, that it's always been kind of massaged into being. Describe that history for us.
You can see that just by looking at some of our neighbors in this hemisphere, merely possessing low population densities and rich natural resources doesn't necessarily create a flourishing middle class. Many Latin American countries, for example, have gone through the Industrial Revolution. They've become urbanized and so on, and they've nevertheless retained very, very small middle classes and even tinier upper classes. As I point out in my article in the Atlantic Monthly of the January-February issue, the American middle class has been created repeatedly. There have been several middle classes created by the interaction of enlightened government policy with market dynamics and energetic population and natural resources.
That argument is critical to your essay in the Atlantic. I wish you'd walk us through it. You start with the yeoman farmer. There again, we think of the farmer as being kind of the natural dispersal of Americans across this, you know, landscape, lightly populated landscape, and presto, you've got farms and you've got people with incomes they might not have had in Europe. You say it wasn't that simple.
No, that's right. If you look not only to Latin America, but also to the American South, where the slave plantations took much of the best land, you can very easily imagine an alternate scenario in which a small number of wealthy landholding families had monopolized most of the good land in the United States in the 19th century. It was the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which banned slavery in much of the North and Midwest, which cleared the way for that vast region to be settled by small farmers instead of by rich slave owners with enormous plantations. And then after the Civil War, the Homestead Act encouraged Americans to be able to acquire title to land that they worked and farmed themselves, so that the American farming class, which sort of seems, you know, it was just a natural phenomenon of the frontier, was the result of an enormous effort of government social engineering, which extended to the removal of the Indians, of course, from these huge territories, often, you know, by very brutal methods, and very expensive infrastructure projects, including a transcontinental railroad and canals at an earlier stage.
So, Michael Lind, was this deliberate? Was it conscious? Were there planners sitting in Washington saying, we must be a nation of a great middle class, and to pull that off, here's the legal structure we need? Or were they just looking to push people west to make room and markets for capital?
No, it was a conscious plan to preserve the republican character of American society. Going back to Aristotle and other ancient thinkers, it was a truism that you could only have a flourishing republic in a country that had a very large, powerful middle class. Republics just didn't work where a small number of rich families controlled everything, much less a single dictator or a monarch. And Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, many of the founding fathers wrote essays and gave speeches that we seldom read anymore, but they were deeply involved in this business of calculating the economic basis for what was at first a rural middle class. Mm-hmm. James Madison, in fact, predicted that the U.S. Would be endangered as a republic by the year 1930. This was James Madison.
He was projecting at the end of the 18th century.
That's right. At the end of the 18th century, he predicted that by that time, the American farmland would all be occupied and that you might start getting an urban working class, which would be a threat to democracy. And he was pretty right, you know, because the Great Depression hit in 1929, and there was a problem with great numbers of landless workers, and that was solved by Franklin Roosevelt and his successors with the New Deal.
But
conscious strategy.
Mm-hmm. But before we get to the Depression, you write about the second great American middle class, which came on the heels of the farming era or the height of that dispersal of land. You point to exactly urban industrial workers. Now, I have to say, you know, when we think back at 19th century urban industrial workers, I'm not sure we always think of middle class, but you say that was the second great bastion of middle class life and income.
Well, that's right. In 1896, so there was a critical election. The Republican Party, led by William McKinley, decisively defeated William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democrats and the Populists. It was essentially the triumph of industrial America over agrarian America. And McKinley and his successors ran on the platform that the industrial worker, which we, you know, nowadays tend to think of as sort of a menial occupation, that this was the ideal middle-class American. And indeed, there was an industrial middle class which succeeded the rural middle class.
But it hardly seems it was pampered into existence. I mean, we have all these images of the Pinkertons coming in and busting up union rallies and Joe Hill and all the rest of it. Was it deliberate government policy to make an industrial middle class, or was it the consequence of urban and labor organization? How do you see it?
Well, both. You have to remember in the 1890s, Samuel Gompers, the head of the American Federation of Labor, wanted McKinley and the Northern industrialists to win, because as long as it was a battle between the industrial Northeast and Midwest and the rural Southerners and Westerners, even the trade unionists and many of the socialists wanted the Southern farmers to be defeated so that they create industrial America. Once there was an industrial economy, labor and business could debate over the proceeds and the gains from it.
And you describe
that was the first great struggle.
And you describe again here a kind of massive social engineering to ensure that a middle class would emerge out of that industrial workforce. What were the elements of that policy, that vision?
The tariff was the centerpiece of it, and immigration restriction as well. From the administration of Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War up until the administration of Herbert Hoover, the Republican Party, which was the party of the industrial Northeast and Midwest, stood for immigration restriction, which got tighter and tighter over time, first squeezing out Asian immigration and then European immigration, and also high tariffs, which reached up to 40-50% for much of this period, against imports from other industrial countries, of which the chief were Britain and the countries of Western Europe. And this benefited the industrial sectors as a whole. It raised incomes for the workers in the industrial factories as well as for the capitalists. Now, the farmers, particularly in the South and the West, paid a very high price for this.
Because they didn't have access to the world markets that they might have?
No, they generally did have access, but they had to pay much higher prices, at least initially.
Oh, the goods they
bought. For American goods than for cheaper British
industry.
European goods.
But you're saying that those tariffs and immigration restrictions once again put a kind of umbrella over the big American middle to allow that middle class to form. And then you describe what you call the third great American middle class and policy that let it come into existence. Describe that turn of the wheel.
Well, this is the post-New Deal middle class. It's the middle class which is sort of coming to an end right now. A lot of people say that we're moving from an industrial to a service economy, but they're about 30, 40, 50 years late. This actually took place in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And so after World War II, you got a majority of Americans were working in service sector jobs rather than in factories or on farms. And you get a new government policy that promotes this kind of suburban service sector class in the middle of the 20th century. Wage income, which had been the only form of income for the most part for the industrial workers, has been supplemented for half a century thanks to New Deal programs like Social Security and then in the 60s on Medicare by government entitlements, by what is called a social wage. So most Americans, whether they realize it or not, you get a social wage in the form of these entitlement programs.
Social Security, Medicare, what else, Michael Lind, would fall in that category?
Oh, everything from student loans. And, of course, a lot of public services that have been increased, where there's been increasing federal funding in particular, like public education. The point is, when the government pays for these things, then you don't have to pay for it out of your own wage income.
So Americans may think of themselves as self-made people, but you're saying in the 20th century, what we think of as a middle-class lifestyle was in fact supplemented by a lot of government policy, government supports.
Yeah, and sometimes it's supplemented indirectly. For example, imagine if you have elderly relatives, how you would have to shift your own financial planning if Social Security just vanished, you know, and you had to take care of them out of your earnings.
A place to live, food to eat, medicine, and the rest.
Right. So there's kind of an invisible effect so that we underestimate how much of our prosperity we owe solely to ourselves, and we underestimate the actual extent of the social safety net and how that affects even affluent people.
So you say that that era is now coming to an end, that third great wave of American middle class life. And what's replacing it? What's the vision, the plan, the big idea or opportunity that will float the middle class boat now?
Well, we're moving from one kind of service sector economy to another. If you look at the jobs that are disappearing, there was a lot of them had to do with routine data processing. We had word processors, typists, switchboard operators. Mm-hmm. These were major growth jobs in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. As you know, receptionists increasingly are being replaced by very irritating musical recorded messages.
Of course, long since.
Yeah, and so basically anything that can be done, at least any routine task that can be done by a computer program will be done in the next generation or so.
So is there a government policy in place now that's kind of helping build the next step, the next, you know, the next big sea for middle class Americans to swim in?
Well, there's not at this point. In fact, we haven't really even analyzed the problem properly, which is that the vast majority of the jobs that are going to grow in the future are going to be in these personal service areas where you have one human being dealing with another human being, whether it's registered nurse, waiter, waitress, customer service representative. Right now, these tend to be kind of very menial jobs. They tend to be temporary. They tend not to have employer benefits. And we think of them as kind of lower class or working class jobs. And that's a problem because if we're going to have a strong middle class in the future, it's people in those jobs who are going to be the largest single group.
But those jobs don't pay well at all. Does that mean that the market, our destiny has just shifted away from middle class life? Or is it a failure of social engineering, as you phrase it?
Well, the market's rules can be changed without altering its character as a market. I mean, there's no abstract natural market. For example, our immigration policy right now, because of great numbers of unskilled immigrants entering the labor market who do a lot of these jobs, the wages are lower than they would be in the absence of that kind of immigration. We have a two-tier benefit system where the top half of Americans have very generous employer-provided health care plans and pension plans, while the bottom half tend to have very sketchy coverage or no coverage whatsoever. Now, those are aspects of public policy. They're not results of the market as such, and they can be changed so that we make sure that as this human service, personal service sector expands, that most of the people in it will have middle-class lifestyles.
But if those policies don't change, Michael Lind, we'll take a short break here and come back and talk about it. But the indication I get from what you're thinking, what you're writing, is that we've got a real precarious future for that middle class. We're talking tonight with journalist and author Michael Lind about the history and uncertain future of the American middle class if the U.S. government has always had a plan for supporting the middle class? What's the plan now? Are you middle class? How's it going? Do you fear the American middle class is losing its footing? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the history and uncertain future of the American middle class. My guest is Michael Lind. His article in the current Atlantic Monthly magazine is, Are We Still a Middle Class Nation? You can join the conversation tonight. If the American middle class was rooted in farming, then factories, then white-collar work, what comes next? And have you heard any politician or economist persuasively describe how the middle class will flourish broadly in this century? Are you middle class? Are you still middle class? How's it going? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael Lind, you asked the question, you pose it right in the title of your piece, but you say, are we still a middle class nation? That indicates some distress. What's the distress?
Well, I think there's a threat to America as a middle class society, which ironically comes from the very success of our economy, which is driven chiefly by technological productivity. The paradox of productivity is that in any particular economic sector, as it grows more productive, you can do more and more with fewer and fewer people, as long as you have increasingly sophisticated machines. We've replaced what was once a majority of farmers with only a 2 or 3% of the country at the most now works in the agricultural sector.
But we're told again and again that this
mechanization of farming.
Right, but we're told that this is a great thing. This is where economic growth comes from. This is what produces profit and expansion
it's true, and
lush
it's a wonderful
jungle
thing
for everybody to live in.
Well, it's a great thing as long as the people who are displaced into other sectors can share in the returns to further productivity growth, which will come mostly in the future from a small number of areas, from robotics, from computers, some of the material commodity extraction industries.
So what's happening? You're saying that productivity's growing apace. Economic growth comes with that, but people who are displaced by this increasing productivity are doing personal services. They're changing bedpans and serving dinners instead of climbing into robotics jobs?
Well, that's exactly right. If you look at the government's own statistics about the jobs that will grow the most, there will be far more of a demand for waiters and waitresses and for personal health care aides than there will be for computer specialists and technicians. And increasingly, as computers become more significantly, a lot of things, even the computer programming that is now done by human beings, will be automated in the future. Now, again, this is not a bad thing. It means that the costs of appliances are falling, you know, mm-hmm. that we're having all sorts of new devices, new kinds of communication, new forms of medicine. So these are wonderful things. The problem is, in this present system, where you'll have a majority of people in this kind of low productivity service sector area, they are not going to automatically share in the enormous profits that will go to the people who own the robot factories in the automated systems.
So are you saying that the United States could become a kind of another Brazil, where you've got very concentrated wealth and you don't have the big bulk of people participating in that?
That's a danger not just for the United States, but for all of the middle-class industrial democracies in Europe and East Asia as well. There are two ways that you can share the wealth that's generated by technological productivity growth broadly. One method, which we sort of have now with the welfare state, is simply to tax the wealthy investors and then to redistribute the profits through entitlement programs that middle-class Americans benefit from. There's another more interesting idea. President Bush has even mentioned this in passing in talking about the ownership society. The idea is that instead of redistributing the income of a small number of investors, you redistribute investment, as it were. That is, you have a society in which a majority of people have significant investments in the economy, including in areas quite apart from their own jobs. You know, so you might have janitors, you know, with investments in Microsoft. And in the very long run, it's something that will take time, of course, they could begin supplementing their income with what might be called a capital wage.
We're going to have to hear a lot more about that, Michael Lind, but I want to invite our callers, and a lot of them are waiting to join us. Lydia's calling from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Hi, Lydia. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to call in to say that as someone who considers herself middle class, my husband and I are both working professionals. I'm a teacher, and my husband is an engineer. Mm-hmm. We find it extremely difficult in this day to actually consider ourselves part of middle class. We're always struggling to pay for daycare. Costs seem to be rising. Nothing seems to be benefiting those of us who earn over a threshold to qualify for government subsidies, and yet we're paying into a system that doesn't pay back to us.
So where do you look for a way out of that, Lydia? Where's your hope lie?
My hope lies that over time we can earn more money and that we can better our own positions, but we can never really, I can never look to the government or politicians to really solve my problems. And it's sort of disappointing in a country that is so wealthy that we cannot contribute better to our health care, to curb the rising costs that tax us as well, daycare to provide for people who are working, especially people who are working as waiters and waitresses or these other type of service positions. I don't understand, or I can't even imagine how they can make ends meet.
But Lydia, it's a democracy. Why shouldn't you be able to look to politicians to at least address the problem?
I think a lot of times I find that the politicians sort of talk about the middle class but never really provide us the services that they talk about. For instance, the tax cut is for, that we recently received was $400 for child care isn't really that effective in helping us.
Doesn't really change your circumstances.
No, when you're paying $9,000 to $10,000 a year for preschool,
right.
You know, it is a big hit into someone's yearly budget.
And $400 doesn't take that hit away. Lydia, thanks for sharing your circumstances there. Michael Lind, Lydia's hope sounds to me at the moment like they'll work harder. They'll hope they can make more money.
Well, it's an uphill battle. The perception of a lot of people like your caller that they're getting less for their money is actually accurate. In my article, I mention a very good book that I recommend to all of your readers by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. It's called The Two-Income Trap.
Yes, we've
Why
spoken
Middle-Class
with them.
Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke.
Mm-hmm.
Using government data, they've established that the fixed costs for the typical American middle-class family, home mortgage payments, car payments, health insurance, child care, education, and taxes, have indeed risen more rapidly than income over the past 30 years. And this has eaten up many of the gains from having two parents in the workforce and from having long-term wage increases.
So Lydia's not imagining something here. It's real.
Yeah, the perception of people in their 30s and 40s and 50s today that their parents actually, the dollar went further, even if their parents made less money back in the 50s and 60s, is accurate. It's borne out by government data.
So if you were to apply this idea that you're talking about, and I've got some fundamental questions about it, but first let's just apply it to Lydia's circumstances. Here's a teacher and an engineer. They consider themselves middle class, but it doesn't feel that way often, and it feels, as you say, as an uphill struggle. You're talking about ways to share the wealth, to make them part of, to redistribute wealth or redistribute investment. How might that work hypothetically for Lydia and her family?
Well, this is sort of a utopian long-term program. It's not going to bring relief in the short term.
But we're talking about big visions for a century here. So we're trying to figure out what to imagine anyway. How would it work?
Well, you have to remember, if you go back to the middle of the 19th century, most Americans did not rely on wages for their income. They were farmers. They raised their own food, and a lot of them made their own clothes. It was only the late 19th and early 20th century that a majority of Americans entered the labor market, where you sell your labor to an employer. And then beginning with the New Deal, you get two sources of income. As I said earlier, there's the market wage, is what your employer pays you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the social wage, which consists of government benefit programs as well as government-mandated employer benefits.
Social Security, Medicare, things everybody's part of.
But also government-provided health insurance. Employer-provided health insurance that mm-hmm. gets tax breaks from the government.
That's retirement kind of plans and so on.
Pensions, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so right now, your typical American member of the middle class gets a paycheck but also gets this social wage in the form of government benefits. You know, why not in this century or maybe the next, why not have most Americans, including most middle-class working Americans, enjoying what the very wealthy Americans enjoy right now, which is a third source of income, which is returns on investment.
I mean, that sounds great, but how do you do that? You're going to take it out of the pocket of Donald Trump and the rich guys of the country, won't they just take their money and go if you try that?
No, I consider and dismiss that option in my article in the Atlantic Monthly. You can't simply plunder the rich and then redistribute their holdings. Fortunately, if you take even fairly modest estimates of how much the United States economy and the world economy is going to grow in the 21st century, based on the growth in the last couple of centuries, it's extraordinary. It's enormous. The problem right now is most Americans, since they don't are not shareholders, apart from maybe company pension plans in a small way, have no means of benefiting.
So, would you require Americans to put the income aside and put it into the stock market, or are you saying the government would redistribute in investment capital and put a little bit at a time into the pockets of those who are middle class and below?
Well, you can't require Americans who are struggling to pay their existing bills, you know, to have enormous savings on the side. That's just unrealistic. But what we can start thinking about, and I raised this possibility in the article, there's a widespread support among both Democrats and Republicans for tax-favored private savings vehicles to deal with retirement in the future. Well, the next logical step is to have some kind of tax-favored savings vehicles, which could be means-tested. You could have a little government support for low-income Americans just to start it off. For investment accounts where you actually get a stream of income from investments without having to wait until you retire, because it's not really true wealth if the government tells you how you can spend it.
So, are you saying I have to save that money to invest it, or is it going to come from the government, from taxes, from other Americans, in other words?
No, for the most part, you would the people who can afford to put away part of their after-tax earnings into these accounts, it would be their own after-tax earnings. You might top up very low-income workers. There might be an element of distribution there. But it seems to me if you start small and let these grow as a result of compound interest and of economic growth year after year, decade after decade, you know, that's the politically feasible way to do it. You're not going to simply have confiscatory taxation of Donald Trump and pass out the proceeds.
Right. Of buttressing the middle class again in new style. Steve's calling from Bristol, Rhode Island. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Michael. I must tell you, I'm really heartened to hear Michael speaking the way he is. Normally, these are very infuriating discussions for me. And the reason for that is that the answer to your questions, Tom, of Michael, have already been answered decades ago by a couple of gentlemen named Louis Kelso and Mortimer Adler, Louis Kelso and Mortimer Adler wrote a book called The Capitalist Manifesto. And the whole point of it is that you can never catch up if you're just relying on your labor to try to put you ahead. You can't do it without the additional income from capital, because there are those two ways to make money. I'm ignoring the government confiscating income and then redistributing it for now. And this is not a secret, but the fact that someone is as knowledgeable as yourself, Tom, it doesn't have the answer to these at his fingertips is really telling.
Steve, I guess the thing is, this is hardly a solution that gets much exposure in the United States political conversation. In fact, it's sort of a taboo, isn't it?
Can I tell you this? This is why it's infuriating. There is an institute right in Washington called the Center for Economic and Social Justice, CESJ.org, and they have all the material you would need to learn how to start implementing the program that Michael alluded to right now. And every presidential candidate knows about this. They've been contacted by CESJ. They know about it.
Steve, do you see this as something that will take decades, or do you look at something more confiscatory, something that would redistribute more quickly, more radically?
Yeah, it would. Here's the point. Every year, there are billions of dollars worth of capital created, and so that there is not a revolt or heavy political pressure from people who own all the capital and who will own all the capital next year, the people who already own it, the rich. They propose, when you start it, to take that year and that year's new capital growth, and it's a little complicated to get into, but you don't disturb existing wealth. You take the new capital that will be created.
Yeah, but that's what everybody's counting on making next year. That's why everyone's watching the stock ticker every day and praying for everything to go up, right? The rich or even the middle class in the 401ks are counting on that too.
Pardon me?
The rich or even the middle class with their 401ks are counting on that capital growth each year for their pocket, right?
That's right. And here's the other problem. Because you have a downward spiral of income from people, they're not making the sales that they need. I mean, this is simplistic, of course, but they're not making the sales they need because the economy is starting to tank a little bit. You're taking money away from people with taxes. You're trying to redistribute it. It's not working.
Well, but it's actually coming back a little bit right now. But, Steve, we hear your support for this vein of thinking, and thank you for your call. Michael Lind, so many questions come to mind. I guess the first is this. I mean, you describe these three previous great eras of the middle class. One is in farming. The second one is in factory jobs. The third one is in office jobs. And now, but the fourth one is in redistributing capital, and it seems somehow to me uncoupled from work. That sustainable?
I don't mean to suggest that at any point in the foreseeable future this capital wage will replace the market wage. The vast majority of Americans in the next generation or two, you know, will work for a living. Most of their income will come from working increasingly in these human service sector jobs.
But are you saying a McDonald's counter job plus some kind of capital redistribution will equal a middle class life at some point? It just doesn't, on the face of it, doesn't add up in my mind.
Well, right now, a McDonald's counter job plus the earned income tax credit, which is a form of government redistribution, the goal of that is to at least create a working class lifestyle, if not a middle class lifestyle. Now, it does seem sort of paradoxical because we think of investors as people who themselves are rich and don't have to work. In the 1990s, partly because of the frenzy of the tech bubble, a lot of Americans began thinking of themselves as investors, as indeed a slight majority are if you count corporate pension plans, mm-hmm. although it's kind of playing with words to say that they're really investors in that sense. But the idea is certainly out there, and why not? You know, as I say, the idea that the majority of Americans would get up in the morning and go work for someone else and be paid a check, and that's the source of your income, this would seem quite alien to most 18th and 19th century American farmers, and it may very well be that by the 22nd or 23rd century, the idea that your only source of income is your paycheck, supplemented by government welfare state payments, may seem kind of odd and archaic.
And everybody in this ownership society would have some kind of dividend coming in.
Well, the great thing about that is it gives you at least a little cushion against excessive dependence both on the marketplace and on the government. And this is one thing that conservatives and liberals never talk about. Conservatives talk about the dangers of depending on the welfare state. Liberals talk about the dangers of being totally at the mercy of your employer. Well, the fact is most Americans are dependent on both. Most Americans can't live for more than a couple of weeks without a major crisis if they lose their jobs and they don't get some kind of government uninsurance benefits. So you had that this kind of economy that we've had now, you know, since the farmers became industrial workers, is one in which you're extremely dependent on other people. There is a very successful government program that goes back to the New Deal for promoting ownership of assets. That's the home mortgage interest deduction, which has turned most American
Many
families
beneficiaries
into
of that.
Owners of their own households.
Michael, in standby. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the middle class having our eyes open to some new possibilities here. What do you think? Is government intervention to get everyone a piece of the capital pie the way to go? Would that do it? And what kind of job is that, or is that old-fashioned thinking? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the history and uncertain future of the American middle class with Michael Lind, journalist and author of Are We Still a Middle Class Nation? In the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Scott is calling from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm Scott, by the way, and I'm a university graduate. I'm a registered nurse in the intensive care unit.
Got it.
And I was listening to the comment about the nursing. You know, I make $60,000 a year. I consider myself making it well. My point is, I think what the middle class has to realize they need to do is we need to taper down our expenses. I think, you know, we're bombarded constantly in this modern era with ways to spend our money, and we're going to have to realize that, you know, you're going to have to live a little more simpler. And with doing that, you can save a lot more. You can plan for the future.
So you're saying, Scott, you're in this personal service economy. You're making $60,000, and it's just fine, thank you. And maybe everybody needs to settle down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, and look in the 50s. What did people have? The average person, the average family had one car. What do we have now? Three, four of the kids have a car. I think what we have to realize is, hey, we can make it, but we've got to make it on our income, not use the credit cards, et cetera, that we're constantly sent in the mail.
Scott, stand by with that thought. Michael Lynn, what's your response? Hello, Michael Lynn.
There's a lot of hello?
Yeah, we've got
There's a lot of gratuitous consumption, but there are a lot of middle-class and working-class Americans who suffer from rising fixed costs, which they really cannot control, and it's the sort of thing they can't cut back on, you know, things like child care, and particularly escalating health insurance costs. So while it's true that individuals tightening their belts could have a little more discretionary spending, unless there are some sort of public policies to address some of these rising fixed costs, then belt tightening alone is not going to help middle-class Americans.
And to Scott's observation that, you know, perhaps we're a lot better off than we were decades back anyway, maybe the definition of what middle class is simply needs to be more modest is kind of the suggestion here.
Well, what happens as technology progresses is that things get cheaper, but human services get more expensive. So, again, this is not a bad thing, but it just means that as society becomes more technologically advanced, your gizmos and gadgets, you spend a shrinking percentage of your income on, and you spend much more money on personal service jobs, you know, on everything from health care
and nurses
really
like
necessary,
Scott. Mm-hmm.
To things like restaurants and vacations. But the shift, that's a long-term shift that you're going to see worldwide in the whole economy, and it's neither good nor bad.
Scott, thanks very much for your call. Lynn's calling from Chicago. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to point out that Charles Schumer, the senator from New York, mm-hmm. was on C-SPAN about 3 weeks ago with a leading economist whose name, of course, I can't remember at the moment, and they were talking about the very issue of the, you know, where do we go next? He said that he was talking to his radiologist, and the radiologist was relating the fact that X-rays no longer need to be read by someone like him. They can be shipped off to India. In mm-hmm. fact, they are being, and even people who go into very advanced training will not look forward to having a decent job within the next 20 years. Another point that was made that there are universities now that are looking at their engineering programs here and wondering if they should close them because it's much cheaper to train engineers in third world countries and then the work gets exported over there.
But Lynn, let me ask you then, I don't want to mischaracterize it, but Michael Lynn is saying long term, one answer to that may be for Americans to be not reliant on income from a job more reliant on income from investments. Do you see that as a realistic alternative or supplement to you know, wage earnings?
Yes, actually, I wish they had discussed this with Charles Schumer because he said he really didn't have any answers, and this particular problem solution was not discussed. So at least this is one alternative to this problem, and I think the middle class is experiencing this pretty much across the board. I have two adult daughters, both of whom have university educations, both of who have been fully gainfully employed for at least 15 years, both of whom are out of work and have been for over a year
in
their chosen field.
It's tough to feel middle class for that long in that circumstance. Lynn, thank you for your call. Michael Lynn, I guess maybe I'm just struggling. You know, maybe someone in the 19th century couldn't have imagined Social Security and Medicare as feasible, couldn't have imagined the degree of government support that Americans became wholly accustomed to in the 20th century. But I have to say, I'm still struggling to get my mind around this idea of wage income supplemented by investment income on a mass scale to such an extent that that would be the thing that floated the middle class instead of the work itself. Is that really feasible?
Well, again, you're a bit beyond my horizon, which is having investment income supplement.
I'm saying supplement.
Income.
Yes, I'm saying supplement.
In the labor market. Yeah, I think you're not imaginative enough. If this were 1900, you know, 1904, a century ago, and you said, well, by the late 20th century, a majority of Americans will live in single-family homes in what is now farmland in these things called suburbs, and most families will have one or two or sometimes three cars, you know, people would have thought you were some kind of insane utopian.
But on a mass scale, doesn't it require labor to produce that mass wealth? Will investment alone, or not alone, but will investment be the margin that takes people from, you know, what would be unsatisfactory in your construction to a satisfactory middle-class life?
Yeah, you're now back in the 19th century with the labor theory of value. According to the economist Paul Rober, about four-fifths of the growth in worldwide wealth since the 1800s has come from technology, from investment in new technology. It hasn't come from labor. It's come from new machines and new techniques for doing more with less energy and less matter.
All right. Well, you are pushing us into the future, and we'll do our best to keep up, to stay out of the 19th century, out of the 20th. Michael Lind, wonderful having you tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Michael Lind, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, author of Are We Still a Middle-Class Nation? In the most recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly. His forthcoming book is What Lincoln Believed, The Values and Convictions of America's Greatest President. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at the controversy surrounding yesterday's racy Super Bowl halftime show and more. This is On Point. Federal Communications Commission has ordered a formal investigation of yesterday's Super Bowl halftime show, which culminated in singer Justin Timberlake tearing off a piece of Janet Jackson's leather gladiator costume, revealing her bare breast to millions of television viewers. CBS, MTV, which produced the halftime show, and Timberlake have all apologized. But FCC Chairman Michael Powell today called the performance, quote, a classless, crass, and deplorable stunt, and promised a thorough and swift investigation. Such an investigation could lead to millions in fines. Janet's breast incident isn't the only part of yesterday's broadcast that's being called classless in some circles. There was Nelly's crotch-grabbing Kid Rock wearing the American flag as a poncho, and ads featuring a groin-biting dog, swearing children, and a flatulent horse. Joining me to look at where the bar was set in yesterday's Super Bowl ads and entertainment are Marjorie Egan, columnist at the Boston Herald and host of a program on 96.9 Talk FM in Boston. Good evening and welcome, Marjorie Egan.
Hi.
Thanks for being with us. And
You're welcome.
It's good to have you. And Carolyn Marvin, professor of communication at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Good evening and welcome, Carolyn Marvin.
Nice to be with you.
Thanks for being with us, Carolyn. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did, indeed.
And did you first? Did you see the flashing breast? But more broadly, did you see this kind of crassness that's getting some buzz today?
Well, you know, I did see that particular incident, but it was so fast I wasn't even sure what I had seen, and it wasn't really until I got to work this morning at the university and people were talking about it and so forth that I was convinced that what I thought I saw was exactly what I saw. But it hardly surprises me in the sense that this is the Super Bowl and it's a festival of popular culture, and it's had sexual messages for a long time. So in that sense, it doesn't seem to me that this is a great departure from what the Super Bowl, in fact, has been as a message for us for a long time.
Marjorie Egan, festival of popular culture. So this is what our popular culture is now, groin biting and breast flashing, and there we are.
Well, you know, I feel so badly for the poor Patriots, Tom. Here they had this spectacular second half. You're all biting your nails off in Boston, and all everybody's talking about today is Janet Jackson's bare breast and how many ads there were for erectile dysfunction.
Well, wait a minute. I take your point, Marjorie, but let's hold on a little bit. There's been an awful lot of celebration, and it was an unbelievable game. It was almost, I thought, the contrast of that ardent striving going on the field and this kind of cheesy, sleazy surround of ads and halftime that made it stand out so much.
Well, you know, when was the last spectacular? I suppose you could say U2 years ago when the Patriots won. That was pretty good at halftime. But generally speaking, the halftimes at the Super Bowl have been sort of tacky. I maybe we should bring back the marching band and have a little Music Man or Julie Andrews or something. I mean, you know, yeah, the talent wasn't very good. I guess Justin Timberlake is hot now with the kids. Why they ever chose Janet Jackson, because all you could think of was how much she looked like Michael Jackson. Some of us thought it was.
And was he
Jackson.
Watching tonight, and where was he watching, and with whom?
Yeah, but, you know, this whole, You know, it's like we've become our parents, you know, and gee, Elvis the pelvis, wasn't he crass in the 50s, and wasn't free love ruining America in the 60s? This is just what's on MTV, as your guest said. I mean, this is what's, I think she said that, this is what's in the culture, from MTV to 17 Magazine to PG Movies, and it was just a more talentless assemblage, I guess, of what you see all over the place.
Carolyn, I guess you're both saying the same thing, that this is what American popular culture is now. Get over it? Is that the message? Am I Tipper Gore in this conversation?
I think that is partly the case, that this is popular culture. Now, it's always been what popular culture is in a certain way, but I think it's a little more complicated than that. And the Super Bowl has become a national festival. It's not directed by the government to be a national festival. It's become a popular festival because we have been interested in it as a nation. And there was, I think, two interesting, I think your idea that people were striving on the field is a very interesting part of it, because, of course, the opening ceremonies were quite different.
Yes.
The opening ceremonies were, part of that message was what brings us together as a nation to this national festival. And the appeal there, the interest there was, one of the things that brings us together as Americans is that we have common ordeals and common sacrifices. So there was this quite elevated from... But in comparison, ceremony about the shuttle disaster that happened a year ago.
A year ago that day, in a celebration of NASA and Beyonce with the national
Beyonce
anthem.
And putting the flagpole up there. And so that's one kind of thing. And that's the other thing that really unites us as Americans is our popular culture.
But I've got to say again, is this really our popular culture? I mean, I thought of families sitting around watching the Super Bowl last night, and the percentage of material in the ads and at halftime that really wouldn't be, you know, your wholesome ideal for kids under, I don't know, 12 or 19 or 20, you know, it was very, very high. I mean, this is George Bush's America, where the Super Bowl, the national popular festival, is loaded with all this off-color humor and cynicism.
The Super Bowl has ever really been for children. I mean, this would be very late for kids to stay out, to take them there. It's a place where there's lots of booze. There's nothing
I don't mean in the stadium, but you've got to be sure at home that an awful lot of kids are watching. The whole family's watching.
But you know what, Tom? You know, kids, my kids, most of the kids I know, are listening to rap music every day in the car.
Right.
When I stop and listen to the lyrics of it, I say, oh, my God, listen to this stuff. And they're watching, especially if they have older brothers and sisters, MTV. If mother isn't letting them watch it at home, they're watching it at somebody else's house. This is sort of where we're at. What I think was kind of depressing is that the ads, which are usually so clever. I mean, I thought that Muhammad Ali ad was great, and the little donkey that wanted to be a Clydesdale was great.
Yeah.
I could have done without the horse with gas and stuff like that. But, you know, P. Diddy and Kid Rock and Janet Jackson was the exception because she hasn't had a hit in such a long time. But that's what they listen to.
I mean, I heard this described today, Marjorie Egan, as a recruiting video for Al-Qaeda. Here's America, the great nation we're all supposed to model on, and this is the popular culture it produces. Flatulent horses. I mean, Carolyn Marvin, am I really just that old tut-tutting, you know, Leave It to Beaver parent of the 1960s?
I think people are certainly entitled to have their own reaction to it. I don't think there's, you know, you can say to somebody, well, you shouldn't feel the way that you feel about it. And I think that's why we have living rooms in which we have control of that knob and we can turn it off if we don't.
You can't turn the Super Bowl off. It's a national festival.
Well, that's a choice that you make then, you know?
Oh, boy.
But, Tom, I think one of the things you're forgetting is that for some people it may be a very disturbing message to assimilate to the family that, you know, here are a bunch of men that beat up on each other, and presumably we don't want our children to do that either. So what we say is, you know, not in this house are you going to do that. And
there was a lot of not in this house from last night. I want to thank you both, Marjorie Egan and Carolyn Marvin. We're almost out of time, but thank you for joining
us
tonight.
Thank you. Sure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy Super Bowl season. This is On Point.